All right, so today's speaker is Frederick Lorenz, also known as Rick. He grew up in New York City and obtained his undergraduate law degree from Marquette University. And he served in the Marine Corps for 27 years as a judge advocate. And he's had considerable international experience, which is what we'll hear about this morning, with the United Nations and Somalia. And he worked with NATO and also worked again with the United Nations in Kosovo. And he currently lectures in the Jackson School of International Studies here on campus, teaching international humanitarian law and international law and the use of force. And he's a senior peace fellow of the Public International Law and Policy Group. He served in the Republic of Georgia, assisting the Georgian government in peace negotiations their negotiations. And in the summer of 2008, he participated in a State Department program in the Republic of Somalia. And he's just going to go again this year. So, lots of international experience. I'm looking forward to a really interesting seminar here on water insecurity in the Euphrates-Tigris Basin.
Thank you. Testing. Everybody hear me? All the way in the back? Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here at the Water Center. I was not too familiar with the Water Center, but this should be interesting. All of you have an interest in water. I'm reminded of a movie that was back in my era when I was graduating from college called The Graduate. And it starred Dustin Hoffman. And there's a great scene in the beginning. This young man doesn't know what he wants to do. He's very uncertain what he wants to do with his life. And it's sort of a cocktail party environment. And a friend of his dad comes up and says, Jim, he says, I just have one word for you in your career. He said, yes, sir. He said, plastics. He says, sir, it's plastics. Plastics is the wave of the future. You mean it's the opportunity. You have to be in plastics. He said, yes, sir. So I suppose if I had this conversation in a cocktail situation today with a young graduate or pre-graduate, I'd probably say, water. I'm convinced that water is going to be increasingly important in the world, and water scarcity is going to be increasingly important. And the Water Center, I think, recognizes that. And you've heard about my background, military background, and academic now for the past 10 years. I've been lecturing here at the University of Washington. And I got interested in this, in water, as an issue of security. You can look at water from many different lenses. You can look at it from an ecology standpoint, historical standpoint, anthropological standpoint, psychological standpoint, political. But I look at water from a security standpoint. At least that's one of the main lenses. And can water lead to conflict? And my first project on water was Euphrates-Tigris, because Turkey happens to be a NATO country. And by the NATO charter, we're bound to defend Turkey. And there was concern about whether or not Turkey might be involved in a conflict over water. So for the past 10 years, I've been researching this, and this will be the basis for my presentation today. So in the past year, I've been refocusing some of my research and writing on Iraq. And you'll see shortly that Iraq, in addition to all the difficulties that the country has gone through now, it's going to be particularly vulnerable on the water sector. And so I use this title I'm using from my publication that I've had, one publication, and another one I'm working on is Strategic Water. Strategic water isn't necessarily the water that comes out of the tap. It's the big picture. How much long-range water will Iraq have? And how will this affect Iraq's future? And how will it affect security in the basin? So that's the nature of our view today. This picture, anybody guess where that picture was taken? That's Deir ez-Zor, Syria, just before the river flows down into Iraq. So there's some very nice work being done at Oregon State on water and conflict. You can find it on the website. Professor Aaron Wolf leads a terrific center there. And they look at international basins and attempt to look at conflict, cooperation, and water stress in a number of basins. And if you can see, the statistics are not precise. The opinions can be different, but most scholars, most experts will tell you that you're in a water stress environment if you have less than 500 cubic meters of fresh water per year, per person. It's estimated already that in the West Bank they're down to 100 or 150, and other places that are already severely water stressed. So this chart attempts to look at water stress. Statistics in this field can be meaningful, political, stressful in themselves. It's not always easy to determine what the facts are. But this type of research at least gives you an idea of where the most stressed water basins are in the world. And I just found a recent article, the World Economic Forum. They believe that half the world's population, which by then will be about 7 billion plus, half the world's population will be in water stress, high water stress, by 2030. And well, what does stress mean? Well, for poor people in Africa or other places, it can simply mean disease, hunger, inability to grow food. And another point is that waterborne disease are already killing as many as 3 million, oftentimes young African kids or in other water-stressed areas. And the stress is on women. When I was traveling in Somaliland just this past January, you drive through the towns, and the women are carrying these big yellow jerry cans. That's what they do. Women can spend three-quarters of their day struggling to get water for their families and are under huge stress from vulnerable situations with their kids and waterborne disease and getting enough fresh water. So it's a huge problem that in turn leads to instability, in turn leads to potential conflict. That's why we should be concerned about it. And it's a matter of security, and international security. And that's the perspective that we can look at. Professor Tony Allen is one of the leading scholars in this field. I use his book for my course in the spring. And the optimists say, well, there's really not going to be a problem. We'll always develop new sources of water. We'll conserve. The pessimists say, we have real problems. We have serious problems. And the fascinating thing about it is that the optimists are probably right. There probably won't be water wars in the next 10 years. But that's a dangerous assumption. The pessimists are probably wrong. But that pessimism is useful. You have to be a bit pessimistic about this. And I've seen this in traveling through Syria, Iraq, Turkey. Water outsiders really have very little influence in these, particularly in the Euphrates-Tigris Basin. I was in a big hall in Turkey just a month ago with water professionals from Turkey, and there was a huge sort of nationalistic sentiment, questions to the speakers saying, why are you telling us how to deal with our water issues? We have the water, and we're doing fine. We will share the benefits of the water, and we can do it ourselves. Thank you, USA. Thank you, international community. We don't need your assistance. This is a very common view in these regions. Internally, some countries, if you're in a dictatorship, an authoritarian regime, do you want to admit that you and your country are vulnerable to that upstream country like Turkey? Many cultures, I mean, if I'm the glorious leader, I don't admit weakness and vulnerability. I don't admit that the water levels are going down to dangerous levels. That's not something we do in that culture. Another huge issue in dealing with different cultures, different societies. So, the Euphrates-Tigris. Does that work? That doesn't work. I'm going to turn something. Anyway, you can see that Turkey, the headwaters of the Euphrates Tigris, are in Turkey, and they flow through Syria and Iraq. A major part of Iraq and Syria's water come from the highlands in Turkey. Particularly for Syria, for the Euphrates, and for Iraq, for both the Tigris and Euphrates. And some of the statistics I'll give you later will show. This is a dangerous part of the world. Conflict in this area has been tremendous. And the water factor is largely unreported. We know a lot about Iraq, invasions of Iraq, security in Iraq, insurgency in Iraq, but strategic water for Iraq and water in the Kurdish areas in the north is largely not discussed at the political level. But it's a huge potential problem. And everyone knows Euphrates Tigris. The Garden of Eden is out there somewhere, right? The cradle of civilization. Somewhere in that valley. I've driven through there several times, not found the Garden of Eden. But this is historically the area of the beginnings of civilization. And the people have always been dependent on the water. Changes in populations, increased stress on the water is a relatively new phenomenon. But even in Sumerian times, there was, by neglecting and by misusing water and water resources, the Sumerian civilization, some scholars believe it collapsed because of inability to control water logging, high salinity levels, movements of the soil and water. So you can look back to some lessons from early civilizations that suffered by not dealing with water properly. Water is critical. Turkey is geographically dominant. And unlike the Nile, where the powerful country is at the bottom of the pipeline, Turkey is at the top. So Turkey is in a good position. One Turkish legislator made the comment, he said, Allah gave to the Arabs the oil, and he gave to the Turks the water, and each should use as they see fit. And that pretty much sums up the views of the position of Turkey, being in that powerful position at the top of the hierarchy of water availability. And this is a very complex area. Military, political, environmental, economic factors all at play. Difficult to understand, difficult to predict, and difficult to analyze in terms of what the impact of low waters will be. Back during ancient, even during Roman times, these are the river gods, Thetis Oceanus. See all those river creatures there with them. So the Southeast Anatolia Project in Turkey, otherwise known as the GAP, which is the Turkish initials, it's been building now for the past 20 years. 21 dams, 19 hydropower, about nearly 2 million hectares or about 4 million acres under irrigation. Turks uniformly believe this is important to Turkey's development. They believe that it's necessary to bring in the Kurdish, poor Kurdish people in the southeast. It means jobs, it means opportunity, it means development, and it is the inherent right to develop those resources. Some hydrologic imperative. Did we go through this in the West in the 20s and 30s? Build those dams. We were the dam building people. We learned some lessons from that. The Turks are going through that today, still building out more dams and hydropower projects. And of course, for Turkey, in a transboundary situation, it has huge implications for the Arabs and the Kurds to the south. This is the Ataturk Dam, which has been filled now for probably 20 years. Up on the on that spillway at the top was the hydropower part. There's some words there that say in Turkish, be proud to be a Turk. It's symbolic of the feeling of the Turks that built this with their own money. Can anybody guess why the Turks were unable to get international aid to build this dam's hydraulic system? Anybody guess why? Why they had to do it on their own funds? That's right. Because the World Bank and other lenders are not going to give you a loan if you are taking potential downstream water. Turkey did it on their own. The power generation is one of the main reasons why the gap was built, and it's more than 90% complete in terms of power generation. The Kurdish people, sometimes known as Mountain Turks, have been an oppressed minority in Turkey for a long time. Things are improving quite a bit there now. But still, the Kurds in the southeast are many of the poor people, and there's a feeling that this will help integrate Kurds into Turkish society and make them less susceptible to separatists and insurgents. But due to some delays, the infrastructure is only about 30% complete, irrigation infrastructure. So does this benefit the downstream neighbors, at least for now? Well, if Turkey's less able to use that water right now, that at least slows down or delays the danger to the Arabs, to Syria and Iraq to the south. This is Batman Dam. All these pictures are mine from my travels through the area, which is on the Tigris, southeast Turkey. Here's a map of the southeast Anatolia project. Just to give you some size, that's about the size of the state of Kentucky. It's big, and that is a photo of the southeast Anatolia project, with those brown areas and green areas and yellow areas are all newly irrigated sections. The area to the central here is still under plans for irrigation. That will ultimately increase the flow into these irrigated areas and decrease the flow of the river. So, what type of environmental factors are at play? Getting reliable data is difficult. What is the flow? The parties often keep it as state secrets. That's changing. I attended a fascinating presentation by NASA in Washington about 2 months ago. Everybody knows Professor Dennis Lettmeyer. Who knows Professor Dennis Lettmeyer here? Everybody knows him. He's done a lot of work in this field. And NASA is trying to get remote sensing devices that will look down and give water data. And this is a whole new field. I think it's a fascinating mix between technology, environment, politics. It's a fascinating area, this remote sensing, and a way to look at this area and give data that has not been available before. Perhaps objective data that could help lead to some level of cooperation. Rather than just having, like a card game, each one is keeping their cards to themselves. A lot of potential for that. But the national laws are largely ineffective. The water tables, in some cases you have declining water tables, in some cases you have increasing water tables with high salinity. Number of difficult areas. There's a huge impact on agriculture and, of course, human health, waterborne disease. The problem is not so much water quantity. The problem is often water quality. It can be both. And now, I'm not going to say anything here, but climate change is a huge factor. No one knows exactly what this will mean in the Euphrates Tigris yet, but it will probably not be good. And changes in snowpack, changes in flows. It's a fascinating area that I haven't spent too much time on, but an important area in river basin analysis. This is a picture I took in Syria, and it's interesting. Those bars. Why do you think they have those bars around the water tap? Well, so you can't get the big your big jerry can buckets in there and fill it up. It's designed for personal consumption. They have a little cup on a string. They're trying to limit. It's sort of a practical way to limit water use at that particular tap. These are kids in Syria. I took these just south of where the Euphrates runs into Syria. A lot of very inefficient systems. There's a groundwater pumping by an automobile engine. A lot of this is going on and very inefficient, very wasteful. They're mining groundwater in many of these places, going way below sustainable levels. Huge problem. This is in just in northern Syria, just south of the Turkish border. This thing keeps going down each year, and they're digging down the well. Only about 50 of 200 wells that were operating 20 years ago are still operating. Huge declines in northern Syria due to declining water levels. High salinity. When I walk near these, they're mining groundwater and putting them up in the fields from groundwater. And you could smell the sulfurous smell from this water as you walk by it. This is a fascinating. Young kids out working in the fields. I think this young lady has her entire family's fortune there in sheep, marching around in northern Syria. So, let's talk about Iraq for a minute. 60% of Iraq's water supply is outside its own borders. The Euphrates flows at about the natural flow of the Euphrates is supposed to be about 30 BCM. Some of you who study it here, you might talk in terms of acre feet. I don't know how many acre feet in a BCM. I'm not sure, but there's a table somewhere you could compare. And the Tigris about 20 billion cubic meters. And what's happened with the dams? The seasonal fluctuations have changed. That's a positive thing, because there's less water lost to the Gulf. But the seasonal, but the dams and the total use has increased, and the amount of water is decreasing. So here's an estimate done a few years ago. This estimate was done 10 years ago, but I think it's still fairly accurate. So where the flow of the river as it enters Iraq, the average flow, which varied wildly from month to month during the season, its natural flow is about 800 cms. It's now down to about 400. And look at those numbers going down, due principally to Turkey's increase of use of the water in the GAP project. So it's hard to be a water optimist looking at those figures. And these figures, if I would show these to Turkey, in fact, a Turkish scientist got up last week in Istanbul and said, he said, we can always provide 500 cubic meters per second. We can provide it indefinitely to Syria where the Euphrates flows across. Of course, that's a statement made in a conference. I'm not sure. But they believe, Turks believe, that this is sustainable. So these numbers, these figures are in debate. There's a map of Iraq. The Kurdish areas are in the north, which are much more stable, and those in the south. Sharing. There's been a lot in the paper about sharing oil resources in Iraq between the Kurdish and the southern, the Shia and Sunni sections, but there hasn't been much talk about sharing water resources, and much of the water resources are controlled in dams in the north. The Mosul Dam, when the U.S. military got there in 2003, massive problems with the Mosul Dam, with leakage, even a potential catastrophic failure of the Mosul Dam was concerned, and there's been millions put into this, but the Mosul Dam apparently still has problems. And Iraq is doing better in managing its water resources, but still, with the U.S. departure, Oil revenues down. There's been much less spent in the water sector in Iraq as planned. Much less has been planned. It's a major issue. This is where the Mosul Dam, this is a satellite shot of the Mosul Dam and the populated areas below it. I'll just mention this briefly. Terrible tragedy in the Iraqi marshes. There's been a lot written on this. It's an interesting topic for a paper. The Iraqi government was accused in the early 90s of punitive hydroengineering. Basically, they dried up the marshes to force and ethnically cleanse the Mud'an people of southern Iraq. It's really a great tragedy, and they were successful in drying the marshes and running the Arab. This is what the marshes used to look like. Basically, it's mostly fields today, and there's some efforts to try to re-flood the marshes, and there has been some limited success, but the marshes, it's unlikely the marshes will ever be brought back to pre-1990 levels. And for one reason, there's less water in the basin. And the Turks are using that water upstream. So the environmental consequences, and for the people of the Arab, the so-called marsh Arabs, it's huge. Here's a map of those pink areas are where it has been basically dried out. This map is relatively recent. And you see below all kinds of potential ecological consequences as the Euphrates-Tigris comes together on the lower right-hand corner there and flows into the Gulf. So, in a nutshell, what are we looking here? Are we looking at cooperation or conflict? It does not look very good for cooperation in this area. There's really no regional institutions. There's barriers, political, cultural. Most analysts and scholars say these water shortage in itself will not cause a war. It's unlikely there to be a shooting war over water worldwide. The real danger is instability, human suffering. Governments might fall. How about as people see their government's not doing anything for them, what about increased movement towards extremism, violent extremism, as instability rises? It's a huge, huge potential problem. I'm a lawyer by trade. What does the law say here? Well, international law is very different than domestic law. If there's a dispute between Arizona and California on the river, we happen to have a court that can resolve it. If there's a dispute between Turkey and Syria on the river, there's no court that is able to resolve it. The parties have to submit it. We have sovereigns, decentralized system. We have an international law commission. We have a framework convention. It took 15 years to draft the framework convention. It was signed by only 8 or 9 countries 11 years ago, and it's still not in effect. Turkey doesn't like it because they believe this will internationalize the system. Turkey doesn't want to be told how to deal with its water resources by some foreign judge. Sounds like the Bush administration position on foreign judges, doesn't it? They don't want to be told how to... You don't want to be told by some external source how to deal with our sovereign issues. And the convention, in fact, Turks like the first part. Water should be used equitably. That's great. Turkey can say, we have the deep dams. We have low precipitation. We have good engineering. We'd be happy to show you why we should make the best use of the waters of the Euphrates-Tigris. We can equitably utilize the water better than those folks to the south. High evaporation rates, high salinity, deserts, and poor management. We can do much better than they can. So we'd be happy to do the part that Turkey doesn't like is Article 7. No significant harm. So this is a legal system built by lawyers, designed to be implemented by judges. So how does this work in the Euphrates-Tigris Basin? Well, the answer is it doesn't. It doesn't work. Is there a potential for law to provide a framework for cooperation at some time? Yes. But effectively now, this is just not working. I, being an optimist, I can say I hope the law at some point can provide some framework here. So, the conclusions from my research and study, I mean, Turkey's going to continue to develop this gap project. Turkey is not the Turk. Turkey will use terms at the World Water Forum. The buzzword at the World Water Forum last month was share the benefits. Share the benefits of the rivers. Turkey would say, we'd love to share the benefits of the rivers. We grow the food and we put it on the market so you can buy it. Sharing the benefits. We'll help train your water engineers. Turkey is very big on sharing the benefits. But are they big on an agreement that puts a cap or a limit on the amount of water that they can use? No. That's one reason why Turkey just hosted the World Water Forum. A display of Turkish engineering skills, cooperation, highly developed westernized economy, ready to join the European Union. But in terms of meaningful promise to share water with Iraq and Syria, maybe not. Certainly, things will get worse. It'll affect Iraq's stability, I think. There'll probably be a crisis. What will a crisis look like? Maybe the government will fall again. A bad thing. Based on water issues, instability, extremism. I'm still an optimistic person. Maybe with a new regime in America, new worldwide diplomatic initiatives. President Obama just addressed the Turkish legislature a couple days ago. He said some very positive things. I think we're on the upswing. I really think we've mismanaged our foreign policy with Turkey. Maybe that'll change. Maybe we can improve. Maybe water can provide a source of cooperation. Maybe water could lead to cooperation in other things. Potential is there for a innovative diplomatic program. Like a few other slides. Anybody guess where that is? I would say where I spent my summer vacation. Anybody know where that is? That's Saddam's swimming pool in the Republican Palace in Baghdad. I made a brief trip to Iraq in the summer of 2004 on water-related issues. You realize when you see the sandbags, you see it's definitely not Miami Beach. And there's the future of public transportation, an Israeli armored vehicle called the Rhino Runner. As terrorism increases, you can get yourself into armored buses. Apparently, Rumsfeld rode around in that in Baghdad when he was there. These gentlemen were my escorts when I went out to the water ministry. Their company was not very well known at the time, but since they've got a lot of bad publicity, Blackwater Security. This is the Iraq Water Ministry. It had been, during the invasion in 2003, it was looted, burned. Now the water minister, the only longstanding minister in the Iraqi government is the water minister. He's a Kurd, Latif Rashid. The Kurds understand the significance of water, and they've been politically very astute in maintaining that connection within the Iraqi government. That's the Ministry of Water Resources. It used to be Ministry of Irrigation. It's been reorganized with a lot of U.S. help. I just met the new U.S. Embassy water advisor to the Iraqi government. interesting work going on. We've been helping them to try to reorganize with their limited resources. I don't read Arabic, but somebody told me that this, I thought it might have been Quranic, but they said, no, these are all the exploits of Saddam in that Republican palace. And the last slide from Iraq I have to show you is, you can quote me on this, I have found the weapons of mass destruction. And there they are. They're in huge 20-foot post right there in Baghdad. So where do we go with recommendations? We need reliable data. I mean, we've got a lot of scientists in the room. Fascinating area. When I met with NASA, NASA's talking about developing this great data system for the Arab countries. They're going to provide. Anybody in the world can go to a website and get all the data on the Euphrates Tigris or the Jordan. And I said, just be aware of one thing: this may not be a welcome event in Arab or Israeli area. This may not be a welcome, because right now, if I hold those cards, if I have the data, it's power. If it's on a website by some American intruders, I don't know. I'm not sure I want to accept that. But clearly, technical assistance is needed. The Army Corps of Engineers has been doing a lot in Iraq. A lot of consultants have been working there. Warning indicators. If we could look at the drawdowns of dams in preparation of drawing down water levels, could Turkey use water as a weapon? Could Turkey threaten its downstream neighbors? It's in dispute. Can you change the whole hydraulic structure of a dam and turn it off? Can you turn off dams like turning off a water faucet? Most engineers would say no. If you draw the dams down first, draw the water lakes down first, and then you build up a reserve, and then you can bring down the flow perhaps. Could you tell that from satellites? Yes. Is there a basis for an initiative? Yes. Confidence building measures. What about starting with just exchanging some basic data? All possible. Autonomous Kurdistan. Where is that going to fit in? Are they going to be in conflict with the South over water? I'm convinced that in the months ahead, there could be a diplomatic opportunity here to build some cooperation between these three parties. There's a lot of interesting models for cooperation out there. Nile Basin Initiative. In my course, I'll talk about my course in a second. Mekong River, there's some sites. You can just Google these things and find out. Danube River. Of course, it's hard to compare Iraq and Syria and Turkey with the joint commission between Canada and the U.S. Hard to compare the political relationship. But there are some basin initiatives that can be helpful. And there's my email at the end, lorenz@UW, if you have a question. And for the last 30 seconds, I'll tell you, I'm teaching a course in the fall here called Water and Security in the Middle East. It's a Jackson School course, 495-90 graduate. I've got a mix between graduates and undergrads. And I've generally had some engineers. Professor Rick Palmer used to send over some engineers periodically. And so I welcome archaeologists, historians, engineers, environmentalists to come in and have sort of an interdisciplinary mix of people in my course, Water and Security in the Middle East. They'll meet Monday and Wednesday at 1:30 in Thompson Hall. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you. Turkey is clearly in a military superior. Okay, good. The question was, how does Turkey's, looking at a military balance, I mean, if there were a conflict, how does Turkey compare to Syria and Iraq? Turkey is in a far superior military basis with the others. Turkey's a NATO country with modern forces that have been fighting the insurgency and cross-border activities for some time. So Turkey has modern jets, helicopters, capability. And so that's yet another factor, layer, that puts Turkey in a strong position here. Other questions? Yes?
Do you think that one of the points of cooperation could be something like a new trade agreement where Turkey, being a country that can better organize and manage their water, would have a discount maybe on some of the products?
Yeah, economics. The question is, could there be some levels of economic cooperation? Yes. Is there a potential for building that? You know, Turkey has been importing Iraqi oil for some time. In fact, what about trading oil for water? I mean, the potential for economic cooperation. Turkey will benefit from a stable, economically thriving area. And that's in everybody's interest. Turkey refused to allow U.S. troops to march through into the invasion of Iraq in 2003, despite the fact that it's a NATO country and a strong U.S. ally. That's what happens when we create a democracy, when we help create a democracy. When we promote democracy, then they vote against letting U.S. forces come through it to conduct the invasion of Iraq. Turkey knew that this was ill-advised, and knew that Turkey would suffer from the economic repercussions of another war in this region. So Turkey's could economic cooperation be a factor here to help cooperation at all levels? Absolutely. Okay, another in the back.
I'm curious about the definition of optimism and pessimism. If optimism is the status quo of 3 million next year, what sort of thing are the pessimists?
Yeah, well, that's true. I'm not. The question relates to optimism and pessimism, and is 3 million. I don't think anybody recognizes that a status quo is an optimistic with all the deaths we have. I guess a water optimist would be someone who believes that technology can be the solution, that people will eventually cooperate, that there'll be new technology that will make desalination of water will get cheaper. Nuclear-powered desal plants can be done. In other words, if I was a water optimist, I'd say things will be okay. There will be no crisis. We have to work to prevent the deaths and limit the deaths that are there now. But a water optimist would be one who would say, we can do this with technology assistance. We don't need to make any major political or cultural changes about water. Yes.
This is kind of a harsh statement, but what kind of responsibility do we have to increase the survival and reproduction of people living in areas that don't have the resources to sustain their life?
Oh, sure. The question is, what responsibility do we in the West, more developed countries, have for less developed countries that are struggling with water stress? Is that what you?
Even just anyone living in a desert, there's no water there.
Well, that's not exactly true. There's not. In fact, I've been helping to develop a new group. I was in Abu Dhabi in December with a new group called the Arab Water Academy. They're hoping to train Arab water professionals to deal. But it's not always true that there's no water in the desert. It's true that historically desert peoples have learned to deal with water efficiently. There's a type of cistern called Qanat, Q-U-A-N-A-T. Anybody ever studied that? There's some fascinating history about Arab and desert peoples and how they efficiently use water. So I would like to go back to that and help figure ways. The Arab countries, Abu Dhabi and Dubai in particular, are making very poor management of their water resources today. Golf courses, indoor ski areas. I mean, there's not a good current history. Ancient history is better in terms of ways of dealing with water. So do we have a responsibility to do this? I think so. Should we, as members of the international community, do things to assist? I think it's in our interest to assist and to reduce the dangers of instability. So I think we should be doing more. That's my opinion. Okay. Other questions?
You mentioned desalinization. I was wondering, how does that fit into the
Okay, desalination is and that's a fascinating scientific piece to that, but and I'm not a scientist, but desalination has been a major factor for countries that can afford the technology and the energy. And that, strangely enough, are the Gulf countries. The biggest desalination plants in the world are in Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and in places that have that energy and money to build them. And that there's all kinds of nasty byproducts of desalination. Salt's got to go somewhere. Where are they putting that stuff? So desalination is not a complete solution, but the cost of desalination has been going down. Some believe that desalination could help solve the water problems in the West Bank and the Gaza, the problems between Israel and the Palestinians. If we had more money to build more plants, could we create more cleaner water? Salinity levels of ocean water. Anybody know what that is? It's like, 20,000 parts per million or something? It's extremely high. Drinking water is 500. To get it down to drinking level. To get seawater down to drinking level, parts per million, is a huge amount of energy and salt byproducts. But is that one way? There's multiple ways to try to improve water availability through improved practices, more efficient practices. And desalination technology, so-called new water. So there's some potential there. Do we have
to ask a question about sewage treatment?
Oh yeah, yeah.
It seems a big issue.
Sewage treatment is an area that's collateral to some of this. But of course, if a country like Iraq if sewer treatment is non-existent, where is that going? It's going into the rivers. And it's causing huge declines in water quality and huge problems in what we've seen here. So I haven't covered that directly, but a country like Turkey is relatively good on its own treatment of human waste. Syria and Iraq are very bad on that, and that's a major factor that can destabilize this whole picture. Yes. So any more? We're running out of time. I have time for another question.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.